It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod, recorded July 9, 2024. And our topic today is the LendVest drug tug scandal in Napa. And our guest is an author of a new book on that topic. His name is Ray Guadagni. Welcome to the Barry Pod.
Thank you.
You, by way of background, served as a judge here in Napa County for how many years?
12.
12 years. And prior to that?
I was a Superior Court Commissioner for another 5.5.
Mm-hmm. And the story we're talking about happened in 1988. So what were you doing in 1988?
1988, I was in private practice still.
Mm-hmm. And of course, matters of the law like this would have been interesting to people in your profession, whether you were prosecuting or defending anybody involved in it anyway.
Absolutely. And also as a citizen, I had friends in the legal field, as a matter of fact, who had been investors.
Yeah. So let's go from the starting point. There was a company called LendVest here in Napa, and I believe they had, I saw in your book, a couple of different locations, but just an ordinary looking, like a mortgage company or an investment firm, nothing special about it, nothing flashy. But that became the focal point of a story after a boat was busted in the San Francisco Bay carrying a huge amount of drugs. So we're talking about May of 1988 when this drug tug suddenly makes the news, and then all of the rest of it starts to unravel. Let's talk about the drug tug itself, who was responsible for that, and what they were caught doing.
Initially, it's Calvin Robinson, a 1960 Napa High graduate who had spent 19 years of his 47 years at the time in prison. So he was a professional criminal. And he was the skipper of the drug tug. The tug was called the Intrepid Venture. And he and his family members, a son, a stepson, and two nephews were his crew. And they had been, unbeknownst to them, under surveillance by the feds in the Delta. And the feds had been tipped off with an anonymous tip and knew that something was going on. So they Norman Wood was the lead agent who was watching them for about a year. And he would be fishing next to them. He would be away from them taking pictures. So they knew this was happening. And there was apparently a run, two runs, one by the Ruby R, which was another tugboat, which brought in the drugs that were used to raise enough money to buy more drugs and to purchase more drugs. And so a year later comes the Intrepid Venture, all under Calvin Robinson. And so the feds were staking it out, and they couldn't track them where they believe they got the drugs from Afghanistan, but got them from a mothership off the coast of Hawaii. And then when they came back, they waiting for him. And May 24th, 1988, the tugboat came into the bay and they were seized. And you'll see in the book that lots of pictures of the massive amount of drugs that were uncovered, both hashish and marijuana.
And at the time, it was the largest seizure of illegal drugs, not just on the West Coast, but in the country?
In the country, yeah. That's how it was reported by the feds. They believed it to be that case.
Wow. The photos you have in the book and the descriptions of how they hid the stuff on the boat, there was the tugboat and a barge that was towing, right?
Correct. Yeah, the contraband was all on the barge, and it was very complex. And in fact, that's what the surveillance person, Norman Wood, was watching, how they were making the boxes and welding things underneath the barge to store all this. And that's how they stored it, so it wouldn't get wet and it would be safe and it wouldn't be exposed to anyone that was traveling by.
So did you say that he was observing them out in the Delta?
Yes.
So the barge was out in the Delta?
It was, yes. And we have pictures of it when it was out in the Delta.
Mm-hmm. And did you also say a moment ago that the bust in May of 88 was not the first time they had this group had imported drugs?
Yeah, and I, unfortunately, it couldn't be connected by the feds at the trial. But yes, the strong suspicion was the Ruby R, another tugboat with Calvin Robinson and his crew, had made another run a year before to raise money so they could purchase even a more massive amount of drugs to fund this. So, yeah, that was a year before.
Yeah. You know, and we're talking about, you know, I guess tens of millions of dollars, which by today's standards doesn't seem so big, but in 1988 it was enormous.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. The first run was like $15 million, but the second run was $189 million of at least as assessed by the federal agents who were talking about street value and things like that.
It's back when $189 million meant something.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, true.
So here's where it gets interesting. We hear word of this bust, a drug seizure, no big deal. There were drug seizures all the time. This was a big one, but my gosh, they're stopping people taking drugs away everywhere all the time. And then suddenly for folks here in Napa, started to realize how local this story was. How long did it take from that arrest in the Bay to where it was, the rest of the story started to come out?
Not long. It was. It quickly led to Lenvest. Calvin Robinson, the skipper of the tug, his sister was Don Lemon's wife, and they had run a business called Dredge Masters, which was a tugboat shipping company, and their address was at Don Lemon's house. It was on Olive Hill Lane. So they immediately raided that and got a few hundred thousand out of various places in the house, including the laundry basket, which I always found ironic because it was money laundering. But
somebody took it too literally.
Yeah, yeah. And so they found that, because Don Lemons was a vice president and chief appraiser at Lenvest, so that got him over to Lenvest. And then the word of that leaked out, and they did confiscate $104,000 from Lenvest, which they couldn't connect later and had to give it back. But by that time, it hit the press. Once it hit the press, there was a run on the bank that on Lenvest, and they couldn't give people back their money because that's when the Ponzi scheme was discovered. It was very quick.
Yeah. Lenvest had been functioning as a mortgage company?
Yeah, they were originally called Napa Mortgage Company, and established by David Hansen. And they were actually very, from what I could unveil and from talking to some of the real estate agents who are still alive and were young and prosperous, they were a well-respected mortgage company. In fact, had they stuck to that, it might have been fine. They were very good at that. But all of a sudden, they started letting people invest in their company and giving them deeds of trust to secure it. And because it was a Ponzi scheme, they had to keep raising money because they had to pay the interest on the first generation of investors. And so the second generation gave them more money, and then they had to have a third generation to keep paying but they always paid the monthly interest payments to keep them happy. But their principal investments were worthless, just pieces of paper. Mm.
This is where it really gets painful. People were taking their life savings, it sounds cliche but true, and moving it from something safe and secure into this, what they didn't realize was a completely risky, bogus investment. And as I recall, people were telling each other, I'm making 30% return on my money. You can't afford not to get into this. And, you know, let's remember, too, in the late 80s, we still had very high interest rates. And so your earnings on a savings account or whatever investment were higher than they would be today, percentage-wise.
Yes, for sure.
And yet, nobody was making 30%. So that was so attractive. You know, you're making 15%. We can make 30%.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly that. It did. These poor people were preyed upon, but it did appeal to their greed. And believe me, if I had an extra 10 grand, I would have probably invested, except for the old adage, which some wise friends of mine would always say when it was happening. I talked about it to them, and the real estate people said, hey, you know, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. But you're totally right, Barry. The going rate, as I recall, was around by the bank was 5%, which we'd like today. But he was offering 13 to 15. It would go up depending on what he was doing. But that was really attractive to investors.
And like, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is classic Ponzi scheme in the way that you give initial investors the full return they've been promised, so they then become salesmen for you.
Right, right. They believe in it, and they want to share that news. And that's what led to some real heartbreak when some, I remember one officer who is deceased now, was an investor. He was already, I think, retired or about to retire. And he invested a lot, I think his pension. But what killed him, I don't mean that literally, yeah. But what broke his heart is he had his friends invest. And when he found out he been made a fool of, he realized he hurt all his friends. That's what really destroyed a lot of people. And David Hansen had preyed upon the elderly and the people in his church. So it was a huge betrayal.
Was one specific church, not more than one, just one church?
Yeah, where he was the treasurer of the Napa First Baptist Church.
First Baptist Church. And as I recall, again, my memory of this from being, in the radio station covering the stories, there were literally appeals from the pulpit to invest in this. People would get up in church and say, sure, you guys all put your money where I put mine because I'm making 30%, et cetera.
Yeah, you're right, Barry. Some of the witnesses at the trial would say, well, I knew about this from a fellow church member, or the pastor himself invested. And Hansen was the treasurer of the church. He was completely trusted. And he was pretty charismatic, I guess.
So how much did the Ponzi scheme collect from all these innocent dupes?
When bankruptcy occurred, they owed $7.9 million, and they only had $3 million. So it was in the negative of that. I don't know exactly the amount of money for all the investors together. The attorney for the trustee of the bankruptcy case said he quoted 18 cents on the dollar was all they could return.
So I guess the profits from the sale of those earlier drugs didn't really cover their expenses.
Yeah, it just funded
the next round of criminal behavior.
Right.
So, like you say, it pretty quickly filtered back to LendVest itself, and then there were raids and people arrested right away. Or how did that play out in the criminal justice system?
Well, Don Lemons, whose house was Dredge Master's address, was arrested with his wife, and then David Hansen was, as well as some of the leaders of LendVest. Which forced them to overnight fire 73 people at LendVest, which overnight led them to bankruptcy. So those arrests were made quickly, not for the LendVest scandal, but for the smuggling of drugs and the laundering of money.
I also recall a lot of those employees, you say there were 73 people
yes.
working, a lot of them had put their own money.
Oh, absolutely.
Into the scam, too.
Absolutely. They were, as things must have gotten very difficult for Hansen to keep raising money, he pressured his people. And he was a devout religious person, or at least that's the act that was put on, because he had a big Bible in his office and he would have prayer meetings. And they would pray about how they were having a hard time making it each month. He would ask his employees, are you a team member? If you are, invest in this thing. And if you're not, you'll just be a peon in this business, and you'll never advance. So people were thinking, gee, my job's on the line. And they'd go home and talk to their husband and come back and put 50 grand in or whatever it was. And if it's okay, I wanted to say that when he preyed on people, they were either, they had some life savings they would use, and everybody wanted the greater interest rate, or if they didn't have life savings, they had, because they were old, they had paid off their house. They finally owned their house, and he would talk them into refinancing. So their interest rate went from very low and almost a paid off house or a paid off house to 1300 a month or whatever at that time was a high house payment. And they'd have to go back to work in their 70s.
Oh, man, that's painful to think about. So Calvin Robinson, like you say, was a Napa High graduate?
1960.
So he was a Napa person. Was Robert Hansen a Napa person from the beginning, or did he come from somewhere else?
Hansen was not a Napa person. It was David Hansen.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all right. I just, I can't remember Barry exactly where, but he wasn't native Napa.
Okay. Now, there's another component here, and this is for old-timers, people who have been around Napa long enough to remember the Joseph Matthews Winery, which in an earlier time before downtown Napa became what it is today, Joseph Matthews Winery was like the hot spot for a while.
Right.
There was a lot going on there, and some of it wasn't 100% legal, according to what I've heard. So how did that get connected to this whole story?
Robert Pittner was the manager of the Joseph Matthews Winery and was a friend of Hansen. And yeah, the Joseph Matthews Winery complex consisted of the Hennessy House, the bed and breakfast, and the sherry oven restaurant, and then, of course, the winery. And it was beautiful. It was never a moneymaker. It was funded by Hansen, who was one of the big owners of the Joseph Matthews. So he kept taking money from Lenvest and filtering it into the sherry.
Sherry Oven Restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that was like classic money laundering 101, right? Because he had illegally obtained money obtained on false premises as an investment, supposedly, and then he's laundering it through the restaurant facility in the winery down there?
No, I don't think he was laundering it that way. He was taking the money and giving it to his employees and having them deposited in the bank, and then they would withdraw.
That was the laundry.
And I should say, to be completely accurate, it wasn't technically money laundering, because money laundering, you had to show the source of the illegal funds. You had to. They couldn't show it. They couldn't do that, and because they just couldn't prove the drug connection. So they charged him with currency structuring, and that was a new law. This happened in 88. That new law came in only 86. But it was, if you made deposits of under 10,000, you didn't have to report it to the IRS. And there were so many deposits in the banks of under 10,000 that the banks reported it anyway. So they got caught.
And there are, as I know from reading the news, there are still people getting caught under that law today.
Yes.
They think that 10,000 limit is protecting them, so they deposit 9,000, 8,000, 9,000.
Absolutely.
Trying to launder ill-gotten money, and they get caught that way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And under that law, you don't have to show the source of the illegal funds.
Yeah, right. Wow, what a story. Now, I have to come back to the Joseph Matthews Winery thing for a second, because I don't recall there ever being any charges pressed, but there was a substantial rumor that the Hennessy House was operating as a bordello at this time. Did that ever come into the story officially?
No, that's...
But you knew that as well, right?
I heard rumors, but no, it did. I mean, didn't. Yeah. Come into the story.
Maybe a bordello overstates it, but like a safe place for high-end escorts.
Yeah.
But kind of
there were rumors there.
Like I say, it was a happening scene down there on Main Street. Fantastic Napa history of the seamy variety, the underbelly, you know, of places where affluence attracts criminals.
Yeah.
Do you think that's, in my mind, Napa has had an inordinate number of Ponzi schemes and different kinds of frauds. Is that why, do you think, because there's an understanding that, like, if you go to Beverly Hills, there's money. If you go to, you know, Los Gatos, you'll find money. If you come to Napa Valley, find money. Is that what attracts criminals here?
I don't think I can say. I don't know. I know.
Spoken very factually, yeah, based on your... Yeah. You're a livelihood. It's always just seemed like the, you know, the thing about Willie Sutton, the bank robber. Why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, fraudsters have preyed on Napa a number of times.
Yeah. And probably always will. But yeah. Who knows?
What a story. So we just kind of scratched the surface. There's so much detail and interrelationships, other people that got caught up in this. The books were cooked. There were two sets of accounting books and on and on and on. Right.
Yeah, oh, absolutely right. That's what really a lot of the people couldn't believe, that anything, that there was any wrongdoing with LendVest. A lot of the investors didn't turn until they discovered that Harvey Grant, who was had all the trappings of a great citizen, a wonderful person. I liked him. Tony Gans, his junior partner at the time, loved him. And anyway, he got pressured to do a false financial statement. He didn't want to do it. He said no, but Hansen, he believed in Hansen. Hansen was his best client too at the time. And he just said, this will ruin LendVest. I can't put that out. I'll make it. It'll be okay by next year. And so he did it. But once he did the false thing, he was locked in and had to do it every year. And that did it.
Yeah, that was a sadder part of it. I agree with you about Harvey Grant. He was kind of the top of his game and got caught up in this thing. So what was the outcome in terms of penalty? Who went to jail?
Yeah, that is a great question, because Pittner, who was also charged, was actually acquitted. He was sent to a different court. It was in Lake County, I believe, or I forget where. I think it was. And the case was thrown out. The real culprit, David G. Hansen, he was convicted in the federal courts for the currency structuring, which we're loosely calling laundering. He got 3.5 years in prison for the federal convictions he suffered there. Don Lemons was never convicted, and none of the Lemons women were convicted. They were hung up on conspiracy charges and later pled for 5 months probation. And that's all the feds. In the Napa LendVest scandal trial, that was there were so many victims that the defense moved for a change of venue, and they got it to Yolo County. It went there, and that was right during the election of Mountner versus Perez. And so Mountner, who was very cerebral and a good prosecutor, he realized that the best charges were burglary charges. And it's like a law school question, you know, burglary. It didn't make sense to a lot of people, including some lawyers. And he said, yes, if Hansen entered your home to sell you, you know, to commit fraud, that's a burglary. Yeah. And that's a residential burglary, which is the highest form of burglary charges, carries the most time. So anyway, I'm sorry I'm not being super responsive.
That's okay.
It goes to Yolo County, and they try the case. And the trial attorney, prosecutor, was Steve Croyer, who later became a judge. And Croyer was a fantastic prosecutor and really smart and really thorough. And his investigator was Ed Wynn, who was a very organized investigator. They probably got the best of the best, the cream of the crop, and those two organized the case. And it was complex with many counts, 139 it started with, and the exhibits, tons of exhibits, and the exhibits themselves had thousands of pages of documents. They prosecuted that. The defense they were broke, so they got public defenders, but Hansen drew Merv Lernhardt, probably the best defense attorney in town. But the evidence was overwhelming. It took 7 weeks or something to prosecute it, and Hansen was convicted on every charge. And the maximum penalty at the time for all that, thanks to the burglaries, was 15 and a half years, and he got it.
Did Calvin Robinson go back to jail as well?
Oh, Calvin Robinson was the one who took the hit in federal court. He was convicted of the drug smuggling and got life.
Wow.
He would have died in prison, but he got a compassionate release at the end and lived for a few years and then died.
What a story. As I said at the outset, there's a lot of people who live in Napa today who didn't live here back then or were kids, you know, or not born yet. But this is a story about Napa Valley that affected so many lives and impacted the family fortune, as it were, homes and investments and everything else. A real tragedy and a fascinating true crime story. The Napa Valley LendVest Fraud Scandal is the title of the book, and the author is Ray Guadagni, former judge here in Napa County Courts. Thank you for being on the show. This was fantastic. I love the true crime genre, and when it's local, it's even better.
Thank you very much. If it's okay, I'm presenting this at the Napa Library in 1 week from today through BookMine.
16th of July, 2024, yeah. Napa Library. Look it up. I encourage you to do so. I love how you can take all these complicated stories and have it all in your brain and be able to tell it in a condensed form like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
That's the Barry Pod, recorded on the 9th of July, 2024. I'm Barry Martin.
You're listening to The Barry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.